One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Is he gone yet? Is Rishi still there?
Four.
He hasn't gone yet because you are yet to administer the final boot up the prime ministerial bottom. I know you're sharpening your quill.
Three.
Justin Welby talks about political issues such as Brexit or the Rwanda plan too often. I mean, he often takes a side on those issues.
The Conservative Party, they talk about remaining loyal to Rishi. What are they remaining loyal to?
We have liftoff.
Welcome once again to Planet Normal, the Telegraph podcast with Alison Pearson.
Hello.
And me, Liam Halligan. Four prime ministers in one parliament. That's what's in the offing. Because increasing numbers of Tory MPs want to use party rules to ditch Rishi Sunak ahead of the next election. So unimpressed are they with our young prime minister's leadership. After Boris Johnson and Liz Truss, would switching Sunak with, say, Penny Mordaunt improve Tory chances of mounting a meaningful challenge to Labour? Or would most voters think the self-styled natural party of government has gone completely mad? There are differing views, not only within the Tory party in the country, but even within the Planet Normal cockpit.
Hey.
Inflation, meanwhile, hits a 2.5-year low. Some good news for Sunak. But Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves has been cranking up the opposition's latest prawn cocktail offensive, trying to reassure business leaders the economy is safe in Labour's hands. This weekend marks the fourth anniversary, yes, that's right, the fourth anniversary of then Prime Minister Boris Johnson announcing the UK's national COVID lockdown, responsible leadership, or the most damaging policy blunder in Britain's post-war history. We know what the co-pilot thinks. There's a lot going on, Alison, and we've got a brilliant Planet Normal guest as well. But before we get going, let's take just a moment to pay journalistic homage, as we so often do, to the Daily Star.
Yay!
Because even by the Star's high standards, the front page I'm looking at now, when it comes to the big issues of the day, is the Star at the top of its game. The headline, World Goes Mad After Woman Goes Shopping.
It's this now famous picture, isn't it, of the Princess of Wales, probably at a garden centre or a farm shop over the weekend with Prince William. And also, Liam, as well as that marvellous headline, richly capturing the complete madness that's been unleashed by people not seeing Kate for a few months as she recovers from serious surgery. But underneath that headline, trip sparks batshit crazy royal conspiracy theories, which is
it. They tell it like it is at the Daily Star. They tell it like it is.
They do tell it like it is. And do you know what? I am absolutely fed up with this story. The idea, we had some BBC journalists suggesting that the woman in the photograph could be a Kate lookalike, not the actual Princess of Wales. We've had mad theories about the Mother's Day photo, which was clearly released to make a cheerful thing at a time where what must be a very, very difficult time for her. I'm not going to go into it, but I do have a very reliable royal contact who has said that what she's gone through is not anything anybody would particularly want to go through. And those details deserve to remain private. And I think the media, I don't know what you think, Liam, I think the media has really behaved badly and has misjudged the public mood. I think most people think, leave her alone. You know, she's been absolutely top notch, absolutely wonderful, reliable, uncomplaining. And then at a time when she deserves to have ample time for recuperation and so on, and she has this stuff, and I've heard that it's really been upsetting her. So I don't know what you think, but I do think the media's got it terribly wrong.
I do, Alison. Of course, we should leave her alone. She's a young woman raising a family, albeit in rather extraordinary circumstances. Leave her alone, not just because she is all that, but also because she has always come across as just being a really decent, honourable, loyal person.
Yeah.
Not that she shouldn't be left alone if her personality was judged to be different. But that just adds to the sense of crikey. But the reality is these conspiracy theories have launched online because they are what we call clickbait in the trade. People click, people are curious. And that's what some parts of the media are playing on. This stuff just generates eyeballs, and eyeballs are what generates the cash in a media business where cash is often very short. I don't condone this in any way, but I completely agree with you. This has gone far too far. In the end, you know, the monarchy is now part of the celebrity culture. There's almost no difference now between royals and celebs, where just a few years ago, there used to be. And if we keep acting like this towards our royal family, then we won't have a royal family. We'll just have a sort of bicycling monarchy, the way they do in the Netherlands or Sweden. And that may be what a lot of people want, but opinion polls constantly show, for all the sniffiness towards the royal family in some parts of our media, the royal family brings a lot of people, a lot of pleasure, and a lot of feeling of pride and security in this country. And I don't think it does anyone any harm, and I think it does a lot of people, particularly older people who might be a bit lonely, a lot of good. And I certainly think Kate Middleton should be left alone.
Absolutely. So what else has been happening? Is he gone yet? Is Rishi still there?
He hasn't gone yet because you are yet to administer the final boot up the prime ministerial bottom. Though I know you're sharpening your quill.
I am sharpening my quill. As you said at the top, we're a rare moment of disagreement in the cockpit of harmony, isn't there really? You think it would be mad to have a 19th Tory leader in 23 weeks. Look, let me just outline my theory as to why we have to have a new Tory leader. The budget had no positive impact at all. They've cut national insurance in the last 6 months by 4%. Nobody's noticed. The disillusion with the Conservatives is so deeply entrenched that none of the usual levers work. I know you'll point to the fact that the economy is getting back on track and inflation is down and so on. We can talk about that in a bit. But I think really, if we're honest now, nothing is making any difference. And the fact is, Liam, is that the Conservative Party, you know, that they talk about remaining loyal to Rishi. What are they remaining loyal to? And I think loyalty is all very well, but loyalty when it's the fate of the country. We are heading not just for a Keir Starmer government, for a Keir Starmer government with a vast majority. And if you could have a leader, a new Tory leader, who could, of course, there'd be masses of ridicule, you know, have Bess Rigby with her little moo sort of scowling at everyone. Robert Peston would be adjusting his multicoloured pashmina in fury. But the point is, it's about the country. Now, there's going to be a huge difference between having a Conservative Party that's been able to hang on to around 200, 180 seats and a Conservative Party which is reduced to below 100 seats, which you and I have discussed this, haven't we? That is possible. And then that means not just 5 years of a Keir Starmer government, it probably means a decade. So I think you could do it very quickly. You don't need to have a beauty parade around the country. I think we need one of the strong women in. I think it has to be Kemi, Suella, Priti, one of those has to get in there. And it did happen. So on May the 2nd, coming up, local elections, I'd be very surprised if the Conservatives hold any seats at all. Now, Theresa May's government suffered what was thought to be the worst Tory local election performance in 24 years. In May 2019, they lost 1,350 seats. She announced her resignation on the 24th of May. Boris Johnson became the leader on the 23rd of July. And 5 months later, Boris Johnson was elected prime minister with an 80-seat majority, 43.6% of the popular vote, the highest percentage for any party since the 1979 general election. It can be done. It should be done.
And if it were done, co-pilot, when 'tis done, then 'twere well it were done quickly.
Done quickly. Yes, exactly.
So said Macbeth, worrying that the murder of Duncan would lead to chaos that would destroy him. And Alison Pearson, Cambridge English graduate, you know that that cycle of violence did destroy him when Duncan was murdered. I'm writing a column for you. Just take notes. Take notes. I think the Tory party needs to be loyal to the notion
that it's not completely mad. Four prime ministers in one parliament. You and I know, because we're political obsessives, because we...
No, you are.
No, I'm not. Alison, you're a national newspaper correspondent.
I can't stand any of them, Liam.
I'm not saying that they're all my best friends, and I'm not a political correspondent. I was for a bit. Yeah, you and I talk about politics. We write about politics, albeit we do it indirectly through the respectable filters of, on the one hand, economics and business, and on the other hand, society and culture. But of course, we follow politics very, very
domestic
closely.
Domestic nonsense. Yes, exactly. I know my place.
I wasn't going to say.
I know. I'm at the price. What's the price of fish? What's the price of butter end of things? I know. No, I care about the people, Liam. I care about the fact that we're heading for annihilation autumn. And I think that they don't deserve to win. The Conservatives have been absolutely dreadful in almost every regard.
They're obviously not going to win. But I think if the Tories switched horses again, even though you and I could debate the finer points of whether Penny Mordaunt or Kemi Badenoch is, you know, to be preferred marginally to Rishi Sunak in the current situation.
Not marginally. Not marginally.
Okay, but all of that would be lost on the public. The public would just see warring Tories, ferrets in a sack.
No.
Even more reason to get rid of them. And any hope that the Tories have got of limiting this so they don't go into double-digit numbers of seats, down from 350 roughly at the moment, as you've been predicting that they will. And I think I agree with you. There is very much a chance of that. But I think changing leader now means your prediction is more likely to come true. I think if you stick with the leader that you've got, however bad he is, then of course they're going to get walloped. But I think the walloping will be slightly less as and when interest rate cuts start to come in, as and when tax cuts start to bite. The reason the budget and the autumn statement haven't really moved the dial is because the two tax cuts in them, one of them has only been in effect in reality for one pay packet in February, and the other one hasn't come in yet. So no wonder they haven't moved the dial, because no one can feel them, because most people don't watch the budget. They may spend 30 seconds scanning a headline about the budget, unlike you and me, who follow these things particularly closely. So I think as those tax cuts come in, headline rate of employee national insurance going down effectively by 4 percentage points from 12 all the way down to 8 by April, as inflation falls, real wages will start to pick up again. That's wages after inflation. Price rises will stop hammering everybody. The cost of living crisis will ease, and there will feel like there's a little bit of respite. I'm not saying there's going to be a feel-good factor. I'm not saying that the Tories are going to win the election at all. They're going to get hammered. But I think the carnage that will be caused by murdering Duncan, as in Macbeth, Rishi Sunak, would eventually backfire on the Conservative Party itself.
Well, we do differ on this, and I am absolutely adamant. What is happening in all these by-elections? The Tory vote is staying home. We know there's no great enthusiasm for Labour. I keep saying this. It's a tiny, tiny uptick in the Labour vote, all right?
No, I agree. That's unanswerably true.
Starmer is eminently beatable. We are not looking at a Tony Blair. If we have a new Conservative Party leader who stands outside number 10 and said, I am going to be a Conservative, millions of Tories, some of us who are thinking, we'll either vote Reform or we won't vote at all right? That's where we are. And I think that if you had a proper Tory leader who said, right, we are coming out of the ECHR, we are not having any more illegal migrants, we are slashing legal migration, we are going to build enough houses for young people to live in, 4 or 5 really clear policies, someone of massive conviction, impressive, charismatic. And I think you could persuade a lot of those Tories to come out and vote Conservative. And they will not do it for Rishi under any circumstances. They are not going to vote for these, you know, the we should say to listeners, we both went to this rather interesting immigration debate, didn't we, earlier in the week? Matt Goodwin and Konstantin Kishin against Polly Toynbee and, or remind me the night, the guy
Aaron Bastani, who founded Navarra Media,
yeah,
which is a kind of left-wing
oriented media organisation.
But it was a very good thing. And on the way there, I got into a black cab and happened upon a Planet Normal listener called Scotty. Hello, Scotty, if you're listening, darling.
They're everywhere.
They're everywhere.
Swarming around London, cabbies that listen to Planet Normal.
But he said I looked nice, which was great. And then he said, well, the way I look at it, I said, the choice of general election is dickhead one or dickhead two. So I thought, how very true, Scotty. So basically, absolutely convinced of this. And I call on Kemi Badenoch and Suella, come on, let's do it. You will at least minimize the rout. And it's worth minimizing it because God knows we cannot have a decade of those useless people. Our country will never recover from 10 years of a Labour government. Not of this caliber. We've talked about this, Liam. I'm not talking about a Blairite government that was full of truly impressive front benches. I really think behind the top four or five, it's just, you know, a conspiracy of mediocrity and worse. So I think they should go for it. And I think there's a strong chance because I think the shock on May the 2nd is going to be so great.
Yeah, it may well happen. And the reason we're talking about it on Planet Normal isn't because we're obsessed with politics, because we're not obsessed with politics, right?
No, we're not.
it's because we know people in politics as non-political obsessives that we are. And
yeah,
we know that this is very much in the offing. We know serious people now are talking about this. Only two Tory MPs have put their head above the parapet and said in public, Andrew Jenkins and Simon Clarke, that they think Rishi should go. But lots of other people are on manoeuvres.
How many letters have gone in now, do you think?
When you say letters, of course, you mean letters to Sir Graham Brady, the chairman of the 1922 committee, letters saying the Prime Minister should resign. And we only need, don't we, 15% of the parliamentary party of 350. It's not very many. I'd say, as a guess, and Sir Graham often listens to Planet Normal and he'll be sitting smiling wryly on the train back to Altrincham, I'd say, Graham, please don't make fun of me next time you see me. I know you never would, because I may then construe something from that. he is the ultimate political sphinx, isn't he, Sir Graham Brady? A very nice sphinx, who good company. He, of course, never says how many letters have been submitted, but I think it's probably around 15 or 20. I may be wrong. And as for your analysis, I couldn't agree more on the state of the Tory party and how disillusioned people are and how imperiled the party is. But I think what you're comparing is the situation now with a situation where there is a new leader. You're not considering the absolute maelstrom of getting from one to the other, the psychodrama that will be seen to have happened in the Tory party by people in the outside world. And I would say about those other potential leaders of the Conservative Party, like, say, Penny Mordaunt, like Kemi Badenoch, Suella Braverman, whoever it is, I would say that none of them want to run now because they want Sunak to own the defeat. Why would they sully themselves by being defeated and then losing their chance to lead their party and ultimately their country?
Because, Liam, sorry to interrupt, but because it's not about them. It's not about their ambition. It's about our country. And it's about, if you give Starmer hundreds of seats majority, you are going to give him license to basically clamp down on free speech, spread gender identity politics. You and I will have to be kind of calling each other by various pronouns we don't even understand.
I'm going to call you it.
I'm going to call you they.
Take that.
Take that. But I mean, we're laughing, but this is our country and they're hopeless. Let's just say, because we have had this better news about inflation, what do you make of the Rachel Reeves Securenomics? Let me tell you my theory, but I think Rachel Reeves has started hanging out with Gordon Brown's old girlfriend, Prudence.
Of course. I mean, Rachel Reeves is being advised by Peter Mandelson. They've dusted off the new Labour playbook. Stick to the Tories' spending plans, stick to the Tories' fiscal rules, you know, give the left a bone, i.e. the promise that school fees are going to have VAT added, business rates relieved, another few radical policies. So the left, shut up and don't embarrass you, don't frighten the horses, so you can secure the vote of enough of what we call in politics middle England, swing voters, practical, pragmatic, not too rich, not too poor people. What Rachel Reeves has done, she hasn't only launched this new prawn cocktail offensive, which, of course, was when Tony Blair, Gordon Brown and the new Labour shadow front bench, as it was, in the early and mid 90s, went around the City of London, went around big business, eating what was then a ever so slightly naff starter of prawn cocktails. I mean, she has basically launched a marauding mass of giant crustaceans that are now invading the City of London and industrial parks in the West Midlands and the northeast of England, because they know that they've got a job of work to do, not least because a lot of people in business feel, while they feel the Tories are a spent force, and they'll feel the Tories are even more of a spent force, by the way, if the Tories change leader. I'm talking about people within the business world, party donors and all the rest of it, a lot of them. They also know that the finances of this country are extremely precarious at the moment. That's the big difference between, you know, Tony Blair coming in and Keir Starmer coming in. Not only, as you've identified rightly, support for Starmer is much shallower than it was for Blair. Not only, as we've said many times, that Blair's front bench in opposition was far, far more impressive than Starmer's front bench in opposition. You know, people like Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, Jack Straw, Mo Molan, Robin Cook. You know, these were very impressive people in opposition. And whatever you think of them, they came into office with a plan to do stuff. And for the most part, they did it. So Rachel Reeves also knows the economy is on a knife edge in terms of public spending. You know, the gilt market could blow up at any moment. Gilt yields are now below where they were when Liz Truss was in office, but not by much. So she has very little room for manoeuvre, very little ability, unlike Gordon Brown, who inherited an economy from Ken Clark that was in growing and it was in surplus in the public finances. Labour are going to be really, really boxed in. And there is some nervousness about that. This inflation number, though, that came out on Wednesday morning, inflation down from 4% in January to 3.4% in February. I don't think it means the Bank of England is going to cut interest rates on Thursday, the day Planet Normal is released. But we are seeing food price inflation now well down. That's at 4.5%, down from almost 20% a year ago. Crikey, food price inflation. And on the year, petrol and diesel prices are actually down in absolute terms. Petrol and diesel are respectively 4% and 11% cheaper than they were in February 2023, even though the prices of both have ticked up a bit. So I do think there are going to be interest rate cuts in the late spring, into summer, maybe into early autumn, provided there's not another big geopolitical flare-up and the price of oil and gas spikes on wholesale markets. It's not going to mean the Tories win the election. These tax cuts aren't going to mean that the Tories win the election. But I do think it will mean that the Tories lose by a bit less than they otherwise would.
So Rachel is talking about stable yet growth, isn't she? Is that sort of poppycock? I mean, can she actually do that? I mean, of course, Liz Truss outlined sort of a project for growth, didn't she? And really quickly came a cropper. Aren't we going to have to realistically start cutting public services, Liam? I mean, there's a vast burden of the state now. How are we going to get any growth unless we start sort of cutting the fat?
Political signalling at this stage in an election cycle, before the opposition roll out their actual detailed policies, they're worried if they do it too early, the government will nick them and they'll get too much scrutiny from people like you and me. So Rachel Reeves is really dealing in themes and mood music at the moment. She did give the May's lecture in the City of London earlier this week, a big sort of set piece speech to the great and the good of the square mile. Very little detail in it. It was all about, oh, we're going to make the OBR a bit more powerful. We're going to make the Treasury even more powerful, their growth units. We're going to stick to the fiscal rules we currently have. And we're basically going to not oppose anything in the Tories' budget. So they are trying just to be a safe pair of hands, as I said, to not frighten the horses. And yeah, this is the way you win elections these days, it seems, in the UK. You don't actually say what you want to do. It's called the gorilla on the tightrope holding the Ming vase strategy. You just creep forward ever so slightly, trying desperately not to fall off. And now on to our latest Planet Normal guest, who joins us this week on the Rocket of Right Thinking, a flying refuge of reasoned views. Amy Gallagher is a nurse and psychotherapist in her mid-30s, who's brought a lawsuit against the NHS, arguing that she was forced to attend seminars promoting so-called critical race theory. Having grown up in South London, Amy's now standing as London Mayor for the SDP, That's the modern version of the party founded by the Gang of Four, including David Owen and Shirley Williams, back in the early 1980s. Amy says she's standing in part, quotes, to push back on woke ideology. But today's SDP will field candidates across the UK in the upcoming general election. It's developed a raft of what they call economically centre-left but culturally centre-right policies on everything from immigration and housing to family and the environment. The London mayoral election is on the 2nd of May alongside local elections, and the nominations process ends in a few days' time. So we thought that it's time Planet Normal listeners met Amy Gallagher. And here she is. You're an NHS nurse. You're a highly trained psychotherapist. How did you get into politics?
Yeah, it's been a strange journey. I went into nursing primarily to avoid politics, actually. So I did a degree in English before I became a nurse, and I found that it was becoming very political and very, I guess, what we would call now woke. And I didn't like the way I was being told to read texts, literature through a certain lens. And I thought, I know what I do. I go into nursing. Nursing will be free from ideology and I can just help people. And then what I've seen over the last 10 years as I've been working in the NHS is that healthcare generally has become more and more politicised. And some of the ideas that I was trying to get away from came into my practice. And this happened most kind of sharply when I was in my final year of training to be a psychotherapist at the Tavistock NHS Foundation Trust, where they were essentially teaching critical race theory, which is a really radical approach to race relations. Essentially argues that all white people are racist and it sees white people as oppressors and non-white people as oppressed. And it was using that unquestioningly to treat patients and to think about people. And, you know, I kind of disagreed with these ideas. And I said, you know, they essentially told me that my views on race weren't appropriate and that I shouldn't be allowed to become a psychotherapist. And they kept pushing these ideas onto me and essentially said that this is the view we hold here. And really, essentially, you can't disagree. Eventually, I was kind of pushed out of the profession. And I guess I came to prominence in the media through a legal case against them, which I started kind of over a year ago now. Essentially, I'm suing them for all sorts of things, but victimization and discrimination. As I said, I try to avoid politics, but from that point on, I realized that actually it's becoming increasingly difficult for everybody to avoid politics because it is having such an impact on our institutions. So I felt like I needed to seek out a political party that would want to push against some of these ideas and against some of the kind of cancel culture elements that we're seeing. Because I don't think it should be down to ordinary people to have to go through lawsuits to push back against this stuff. Speaking as someone who's going through a lawsuit is incredibly stressful. And I wish that there was a party that could stop these ideas and I could just vote for them rather than having to go through a legal case. So that's when I really found the SDP to be, I'm sick of Labour and Tories. All of this stuff has happened under the Tories. And I found the SDP's policies and manifesto to be extremely appealing. So I got involved with the SDP about a year ago. From there, I couldn't have imagined, but what sort of unfolded.
Huge respect to you. You're a regular girl from South London, right? You grew up in a really diverse part of the country. But how does it feel for someone from your background to be told that you're racist? How does it feel to be part of an institution that's saying on its own website, the problem of racism is a problem of whiteness, holding seminars, whiteness, a problem for our time? That must have really wound you up.
It's a very painful thing to go through. I mean, as I said, I've always lived in South London and I've been treating patients of all different ethnic backgrounds and religious backgrounds. You know, it's never been an issue. I'm working in some NHS hospitals, you know, where I've been a minority as a white person and I've been able to get along with pretty much everyone in the NHS. This issue never comes up. Actually, I think, you know, the NHS is a really amazing example of how people from different backgrounds and different ethnicities really can properly work together and get along. So, you know, these ideas, I just think what they're doing is they're taking us backwards and they're creating divisions where there wasn't any, and they're creating resentments where there doesn't have to be. And, you know, their ideas are actually, as I've said, you know, really racist, actually. And they're teaching people to judge people on the colour of their skin rather than as individuals. So it's a crazy world we're living in at the moment where everything feels very topsy-turvy. I was aware of these ideas in kind of America. And I thought they wouldn't come here. They wouldn't come to the UK. We're a bit more sensible. they might end up in academia, but not in healthcare. I just couldn't believe it. I still, to this day, I'm quite shocked by it.
Let's talk a little bit about the SDP. Now, this is separate from the SDP that was founded by Shirley Williams, Dr. David Owen, back in the early 80s, long before you were born, if I may say so. Though Dr. David Owen is today, he's not unsupportive of your doing what William Clouston, your leader, who's been on Planet Normal in the past, is doing. Am I right in saying that today's SDP, you're basically left on economic issues, on fiscal issues, but you're right sort of slash traditional on social issues? You've described yourself, haven't you, as culturally conservative and economically left.
Pretty much. I would say, you know, economically centre-left or you know, maybe centrist. But, you know, I'm definitely not, I wouldn't place myself as being at the same lines as Reform in that I'm not Thatcherite. I do want there to be an NHS. I do want there to be a really robust welfare system. I just want it to work. I do want there to be safety nets for people. And I don't want everything to be privatised. But I just don't think our current system is working. Yeah, I think we really do need a political party that really takes kind of the issues that we're seeing in our institutions seriously. That's why I felt like the SDP was a sort of perfect fit for me. They're really strong on issues like immigration. You know, they absolutely want to put a pause on immigration for 5 years. They probably have, I think, one of the strongest policies around immigration than any of the other parties. There's aspects of them that they're not kind of totally right wing. They're actually quite nuanced and really measured in their thinking about the UK and some of the issues we're facing.
Now, you've said London has become more divided. You've said that the current mayor, of course, Labour's Sadiq Khan, is, in your words, spending too much money on campaigns that are all about virtue signalling. I'm sure a lot of people would agree with that. Certainly a lot of very prominent commentators have nodded their sympathy with the SDP, haven't they? We've got, you know, Patrick O'Flynn, we've got Rod Little, our own co-pilot Alison Pearson has written in sympathy of the SDP as well. But what else do you want to do, Amy? What are your other policies that you'd highlight when people vote for London Mayor on May the 2nd?
So, I mean, one thing that we're seeing, you know, that's really come to the fore in the last kind of several months is policing. We've seen how our police are absolutely captured. We're seeing, you know, really quite extreme examples of two-tier policing. And people just generally feel like the police can't be relied upon to police fairly. We're seeking to depoliticise the police, depoliticise as well public transport. As you said, there's a lot of, it's so hard to move around London and not seek some kind of message or ideology being pushed onto you. And I think this just winds up so many people. So we're wanting to neutralise everything. We also want to be tougher on crime. People feel that there's a real rise in antisocial behaviour and incivility on public transport. Things just feel more hostile everywhere on the streets and on public transport. So we really want to have a kind of zero tolerance approach to crime and to antisocial behaviour so that people can just feel generally safer. A huge area that the SDP focus on generally is housing. William Clouston, our leader, was a town planner, and obviously housing is a massive issue just across the UK.
And he's hugely knowledgeable about housing, if I may say so, having discussed it with him at great length over the last couple of years.
I've learned a lot already from doing this mayoral process. I've met with some people who've been very influential and successful in the areas of housing. And, you know, I've been quite shocked by how they're telling me how there's so many innovative people out there that can think of ways to solve the housing issues. And Sadiq Khan essentially just ignores them. He's not interested in it. He's pledged that he was going to increase houses by 26,000 by 2026. And that hasn't happened. He's only increased housing by about 2.8% in terms of what his original goal was. He just doesn't give the area of housing, you know, I don't think he gives it much attention. So what we would really be seeking to do as an SDP mayoral candidate is I would be wanting to, well, of course, build more houses, but I'd be wanting to bring some of the best thinkers, architects, planners involved and really tackle this issue head on. We want to produce an accurate register of the spare or wasted public land and try to see if we can get release of that public land so we can build more. We want to intensify the land in the outer boroughs of London. But generally, I mean, of course, housing, one of the significant issues is mass immigration. Now, of course, the mayor doesn't have powers to stop mass immigration. But what we do have at the moment is a mayor who just doesn't seem to talk about this issue. And I think many people just find it maddening because I mean, we know that London is kind of more populated now than ever. It's absolutely bursting at the seams. And we know mass immigration has played a massive role in that. I think at the SDP, you know, we talk quite frankly about these issues in a way that other parties don't.
Amy, tell me how your Christianity has shaped your politics. Sometimes in public life, the English in particular, the British in general, were a bit, as the Americans say, icky about talking about religion and politics. But I know your faith is important to you.
Yeah, definitely. And unfortunately, you know, that's another institution or another aspect of our culture that's being attacked. I feel increasingly let down by the Church of England. And, you know, I don't feel entirely comfortable with the Church of England because they are becoming increasingly politicized. It feels like they're not advocating for Christian values. They're advocating for ideology above religion. And
give us an example of that, Amy. Something the church has said or done that's really made you...
Yeah, so for example, I think Justin Welby talks about political issues such as Brexit or the Rwanda plan too often. I mean, he often takes a side on those issues. So he recently said that the Tories' Rwanda bill went against the nature of God. I have no idea how he knows what God's view is on a Tory policy. But to me, he behaves like a Labour MP more than a religious leader. And we've seen just increasingly that critical race theory and movements like Black Lives Matter are taking over the church. There was recently a call for the Church of England to undergo a race action plan to bring more ethnic minority priests into the Church of England. The issue is with all of this is that the church and religion is a very specific thing. It's not just like a normal employment. You have a calling to go into the church, and the idea that priests would be picked on their skin colour, firstly, I mean, it just goes against the Christian value of everybody is equal under the eyes of God. You know, it's imposing something from outside onto the church. There was calls for the church to give reparations for slavery, and the amount that they're asked to give keeps going up and up. What we're seeing is a Church of England that is becoming increasingly politicised, and it seems to be talking more about politics than it is talking about the spiritual world or what's important spiritually. But I would say my Christianity is what's helped me through my legal case, and it's what's helped me with all of the difficult things I've been facing, because it puts things into perspective. I mean, the world of politics and law can be very complicated, it can be very ego-driven, and it can be very tiring and very difficult. And the thing that I return to is God and thinking of something bigger. And what it's helped me is to not be angry about things that have happened to me. It's allowed me to let go of resentment. It's allowed me to think of things, put things into perspective. And I've noticed with this legal case and everything that's happened to me, it has felt like every time I've asked God for something, so, you know, I really need help with this, things have come into my life that have helped me. So it really has strengthened my faith, actually.
How do you think the bigger parties, Amy, are conducting themselves when it comes to British politics? Labour, the Tories, the Lib Dems. Couldn't you just vote for one of them?
I mean, I think people have been utterly let down by all of them. You know, I think the Conservative Party, they got this 80-seat majority. The Red Wall lent them their vote, and they've been totally and utterly let down. We now, with Rishi Sunak and David Cameron as Foreign Secretary, we essentially returned to a kind of Blairite politics. I actually think there's not that much difference between Labour and Tory. As a third option, the Lib Dems, I think people absolutely lost complete trust in them when they formed the coalition. So I think people just feel like they're all much of the same. And I think that's why people just feel like I just can't be bothered. So many people just say, I hate politics, I hate politicians. People often vote now, I think, to stop the one that they hate the least. It's not like I really passionately believe in Labour. It's I'll vote Labour because I don't like the Tories, or I'll vote Tory because I don't like Labour. It's not very often you hear someone say, you know, I really passionately believe in this political party. I feel really infused and excited about voting for them. It's often they're all awful, but I'll vote for the least awful one. So that's why I really felt like, you know, I'm just done with the major parties now. I want to vote in a positive way and for something that I really believe in. So that's why I was drawn to the SDP, even though they're a really small party. You know, they're not going to be winning major elections anytime soon. But when I vote, I really feel like, yeah, I'm actually voting for something that summarizes my views, and I feel really represented by them. And I feel like I'm really voting in a positive way, other than just voting because I hate someone else. I think maybe after the next election, the smaller parties will grow, because I think there will be an increased dissatisfaction with the major parties.
And what does success look like for you on May the 2nd? The SDP aren't going to win this election. You're not going to be the London mayor. But what would be a result that would satisfy you?
So, as you said, we're very small. We got a very small, less than 1% of the vote last time. I guess I'd be really looking to increase our vote. It'd be great if we could, you know, double the vote, I guess. I mean, this mayoral campaign is a real good opportunity for us to get our policies out there and to increase our membership and for more and more people to be aware of us.
If you get 5%, you're in the London Assembly, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I would be, yeah.
Crikey, I bet you'd rouse a bit of dust once you got into that chamber.
Yeah, oh my God, that's terrifying. I mean, yeah, stranger things have happened. There is a possibility, yes, and I am aware of that, but we'll see. This campaign is a real chance for us to get our policies out there and to increase our membership. You know, I speak to people, they do remember the SDP from the days of David Owen, but they often don't know that we're sort of back. When you tell them, we know from polling and we know from the research of Matt Goodwin that the SDP's policies, i.e. being economically left and culturally conservative, really do fit with about 50% of the electorate. There's so many people who we think would be perfect for the SDP, but they just don't know about us. I think a lot of those red wall voters would be very interested in our policies and would find us very appealing, but they just don't know we exist.
Well, now you've been on Planet Normal, Amy, a lot more people will know that you exist and you're standing for London Mayor. Thanks a lot for appearing on Planet Normal.
Thank you, Liam. Thank you for having me.
So there she is, Alison, Amy Gallagher, ahead of mayoral elections on May the 2nd in London.
I think she's great. Really wish her well in the election. Obviously, they've got a mountain to climb. I respond to the SDP prospectus, the culturally conservative William Clouston's party really puts a premium on community cohesion. They've suggested a 5-year freeze on immigration, precisely with a view to improving our sort of national sense of self and a bit more economically left-wing as well. But I think Amy speaks from the heart going into nursing, thinking she's going to be doing a great practical job helping people, and suddenly discovering they're forcing all this pernicious garbage down the throat of NHS workers. What do you think? Are we seeing a pushback now?
I think we definitely are. I think we're seeing a pushback in quite a few areas of politics. I think the net zero debate is starting to become realistic. You know, people who, you know, want us to use less hydrocarbons in general, but, you know, have genuine knowledge about the technicalities of getting there, are starting to get a bit of a fair hearing. Government policy in that area, while still many people, certainly Martin Durkin, who we had on the podcast recently, would say their policies remain mad, you know, the government is starting to slightly trim its sails, moving the ban on new petrol and diesel cars from 2030 to 2035, where it, after all, it is across the European Union. And later today, after we finish recording Planet Normal, I'm off to an event which I've been asked to host and be the presenter at, where the Secretary of State, Kemi Badenoch, is going to introduce this new inclusion at work report. This is something which the government commissioned to look at, in a business context, what are called EDI initiatives, equality, diversity and inclusion initiatives. You know, the public sector and the private sector are spending tens of millions of pounds on these things every year. And so Kemi Badenoch, who as well as being Secretary of State for Business and Trade, is also, of course, Minister for Women and Equalities. She got this panel of 9 people together from across business, the private sector, the public sector. And she's written in the Telegraph today, Wednesday, and the link will be in the show notes of this episode, a piece about this newly published report, which surveyed many, many businesses, many, many meetings, discussions with businesses. The new Inclusion at Work report, the Secretary of State says, shows that while millions are being spent on these initiatives, many popular EDI practices, such as diversity training, have little to no tangible impact in increasing diversity or reducing prejudice. In fact, the Secretary of State writes, many practices have not only been proven to be ineffective, they have also been counterproductive. Now, many people, certainly many normal listeners who have written to us about this stuff, saying that they've been insulted in their workplace. They've left work. They've retired early because all this stuff just winds them up because it seems so ridiculous. Many of them will think that what Kemi Badenoch just wrote there in the Telegraph is nothing but plain common sense. But sometimes getting plain common sense into the political mainstream, when a lot of the political mainstream has gone mad, can be a process that's fraught with political danger. And that's where we are.
Yeah, but what a sign of the times. I mean, you know, we love Kemi on Planet Normal. She's another of our patron saints, isn't she? I mean, just talking about what she calls performative gestures such as compulsory pronouns and rainbow lanyards. Yet, you know, what contribution are they making except coming at the expense of white men? And I've said to you, Liam, from correspondence we've had, I really think that the workforce now is, as you say, losing a lot of these reviled white males. So I think you are getting this momentum now. Congratulations to Kemi Badenoch for calling it out and saying, why are we spending tens of millions on this when it's actually leading to more cases of discrimination at tribunals, not fewer? That's extraordinary, isn't it? But coming back, co-pilot, to the why we need a new Conservative leader, could there be somebody with the initials KB who might be persuaded if the Halligan passed her a fiver later on today?
Now on to our listener emails. Your messages sent to planetnormal@telegraph.co.uk. Please keep them coming. We love to read your thoughts, the citizens of Planet Normal.
And can I just say, we've been having so many great emails that they are turning up as front page stories in the Daily Telegraph. We've had 6 or 7 of those in the last few months. So if you've got a good story, we'll find a home for it. We absolutely love what you send to us. These particularly raft of correspondence this week on lots of the gender identity stuff. Eleanor says, I read Alison's alarming Telegraph column on preachers of gender ideology in schools. One such third-party provider, People Change Minds, came into my daughter's school. I have a year 7 and a year 9. The organisation is employed by many London private schools. I'm attaching screenshots to some of the slides from an online presentation to parents. You will notice who is cast as the monster of shame: parents, teachers, and the church. I was going to complain to the school, says Eleanor, but they had a snap inspection, so I put it into my feedback to the inspectors. People Change Minds have changed their website slightly, but the content of what they preach, as far as I can see, is still not required by the national curriculum. Their trick is to tick some curriculum boxes, but to add in extra gender ideology. This stuff has had a significant detrimental effect on at least one family at the school, I'm sad to say. These groups have acquired so much power because schools don't feel equipped to teach PSHE, and so they outsource it. Political activists have seized the opportunity, unfortunately. And Diana says, sorry, Alison, I hate to disappoint you, but the trans ideology isn't in retreat at all. I have this from a very good source that currently, listen to this, Liam, half of the mastectomy surgeries at one major hospital in the Northwest are for gender reassignment on the NHS. Perhaps some data is required under the Freedom of Information Act. I have asked Diana, I've put that through to our news desk. And finally, from Paul, Paul says, a friend who's a teacher in Wales told me that an obvious late 50s man dressed in a red wig and women's clothes from an outside organisation came into their school teaching 12 to 13 year old pupils about trans ideology. The only qualification to teach this stuff, apparently, is dressing like the opposite sex. If I dress up as Albert Einstein, will I be allowed to teach double physics?
We also had a huge response, email bag, to our interview with Martin Durkin, who I mentioned. Martin is a very distinguished filmmaker. A lot of people try and underplay his filmmaking credentials, but he's had films on many of our major mainstream broadcasters, and he is widely respected across the industry. His new film on climate change is coming out 21st of March, free on the internet, if you just Google Martin Durkin. His surname is D-U-R-K-I-N. Bruce says, dear co-pilots, great episode as usual. Thank you, Bruce. Martin Durkin is a necessary and courageous giant of our democracy. I look forward to his latest opus. His words ring true, but they also struck a chord with an earlier email I sent to Planet Normal describing the top-down revolution we've suffered over the last 25 years. There is a democratic deficit against which Brexit offered merely token resistance. Our bureaucracy, NGOs, academia, media, backed by opaque legislation, all require a counter-revolution, says Bruce, involving political leadership and grassroots civic movements. New Labour and the Tories, hang your heads in shame. And Bruce says, since the Industrial Revolution, economic growth and human flourishing have been based on cheap, abundant and readily available energy. Nothing's changed or will change until new tech such as nuclear fusion appears. What can we do in the meantime is continue the trend towards cleaner and more efficient use of fossil fuels, gas for coal, internal combustion engine and hybrid engine design taken to the ultimate. New gas-fired power stations are a start, but without the vital ingredient of domestic oil and gas, there's neither energy, security, nor cheap fuel. Moreover, we must recognise, says Bruce, that today's rudimentary renewable energy is far from environmentally friendly, something which the cultists simply refuse to recognise. It's resource-intensive, requiring ever larger holes to be dug in the ground with damaging refining processes. It will require a huge amount of infrastructure matched by a giant carbon footprint. The countryside and its flora and fauna will be scourged with windmills, the blades of which have a short life and can't be recycled. Valuable pasture covered with solar farms, pylons cutting through swathes of woodland. Saruman would be proud. As earlier guests on Planet Normal have pointed out, net zero aspiration is not matched by the feasibility of it. Increasing our demand for electricity fivefold will not be met with the ability to develop resources in the time allowed, train the engineers, or build and finance the rollouts of the required infrastructure. The upfront cost is huge. And finally, demand for energy globally is increasing at a rapid pace. The move to a digital economy, growth in regions such as Asia is going to consume and require not just fossil fuels. This is why China is developing renewables alongside coal, fire and nuclear. As you say, Alison, maybe the penny will drop when even the protagonists of net zero discover they can't charge their smartphones and their electric vehicles, hopefully coming to a halt on a Welsh hillside unable to call for help. Of course, those of us who recall with nostalgia huddling round the dinner table by candlelight during the miners' strike will allow ourselves a little chuckle. Keep on keeping it normal. With thanks, Bruce.
So, Liam, it's quite interesting. You'll notice that Wales has got a new First Minister in Vaughan Gething, being acclaimed as the first black leader of any European country. But I have to say that there are very, very mixed views about the dominance of Labour in Wales. And this is Juan in Wales, actually, a Spanish man living in my native land. Hi, Alison and Liam. I currently live in Wales, and day after day, month after month, I'm amazed at the level of insanity of Welsh Labour and all the people who support them. Now Wales is undeservingly rewarding Vaughan Gething as First Minister. Let's not forget that as Wales's former Minister for Health and Social Services, he was responsible for co-developing and delivering the nonsense policies we coped with during the COVID pandemic, like restricting the sale of books as they were classed as non-essential items. Another example of the big failure behind the devolution project. Sadly, the Welsh are so tragically tribal and ever so attached to the narrative that Westminster is against them that they will keep voting for Labour. Wales is literally a one-party state now. Moreover, Labour profits from this and continues to refuse responsibility for anything, including the huge levels of economic inactivity and poverty, the negative state of the Welsh NHS, or the fact that their actual policies, like the 20-mile-an-hour speed limit, is wildly unpopular and doesn't even work. They have been successful, though, at using the Welsh language as a political weapon, disguised as an educational and historical necessity, to keep the animosity between the Welsh and the English very much alive. So what's the alternative? How can Wales be rescued from this madness? Labour is comfy in power here, the electorate is unable to think critically, and the Tories hardly bother to fight for the union. They're neither the Conservative nor the Unionist Party anymore. If only they realise that most Welsh people are actually traditionalists at heart. Dare I say it, one nation Conservatives. By the way, I agree with you, Juan, very socially conservative, the Welsh. Things would look a lot different here. We need courageous leaders, but I can't see any on the horizon. Many thanks for reading this email and keep up the great work. Best wishes, Juan, Spanish for John, from Wales. Thanks, Juan.
And finally, Alison, He's done it again. Bob the Bard has struck the multiple mug winner. Here he is. Dear Planet Normal, I really enjoyed your interview last week with Martin Durkin. I look forward to watching the film. Unfortunately, I'm afraid your discussion about net zero zealots inspired me to write yet another god-awful
poem. Oh, no.
Thanks again for Planet Normal, our fearless heroes. The windmills of their minds. This is by Bob the Bard, with apologies to Noel Harrison, who did, of course, sing the original, a very evocative song of the late 1960s. Like a medieval cult of doom, net zero rules our land. With zealots spouting dodgy science they barely understand. The technologies they're pushing are immature at best. They may suit those with lots of cash, but they'll bankrupt all the rest. They're crippling our economy with their targets and their fines. But the real world doesn't matter in the windmills of their minds. The stats for carbon footprints are something of a fraud. Have we really slashed emissions or just exported them abroad? Nuclear is an option, but the zealots like it not, preferring wind and solar to provide our gigawatts. But what happens when there is no wind and the sun just doesn't shine? Well, I'm afraid there are no answers in the windmills of their minds. That's up there with his best.
He's even written it so it sounds like the song, you know.
By the way, the controversial view, but I think a rare occasion, Halligan, when the sequel, or not the sequel, a remake was better than the original. I think
you like the Pierce Brosnan one? Well,
I love Pierce Brosnan because I met him and he said Alison Pearson five times to me. He was on the set of when they were filming my movie. I don't know how she does it, but Pierce Brosnan and Rene Russo in that film.
If Rene Russo in the glider. They go up in the glider, don't
go
they?
Go up in a glider. If you've got a horrible wet night in, sit down and stare at those two beautiful humans.
But you look more like Renée Zellweger than Rene Russo. That's certainly what they say in the King's Arms.
It is what they say in the King's Arms, but only after several pints.
And on that bombshell, can't escape there. That was dangerous. That's it from Planet Normal for another week. As we leave our sanctuary of sweet reason, our flying refuge of reasoned views, email of the week, it's my turn. It's got to be Bruce. Bruce, you've done it. You've got your Planet Normal mug. Send us an email to planetnormal@telegraph.co.uk and put in the subject heading, mug winner. And a rare as rocking horse poo Planet Normal mug will wing its way to you.
If you enjoy Planet Normal, please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. We've got some absolutely lovely ones there, and it gives us huge pleasure and consolation in these mad rainy times to read them.
And as we speed away from our beloved Planet Normal and the madness of Planet Earth comes back into view, thanks as ever to our producers Isabel Bajard, Elliot Lampitt, Cass Ho and Louisa Wells. Stay safe and in touch with us and with each other. Until next week, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.